Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Andrew Leibovich, a PhD candidate in Columbia University's History Department and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations.
In this episode, we talked about the various jihadi groups that have been active in Mali over the past few years, the political process in Mali after the French intervention, why there has been a rise in violence recently, why the Islamic State has not been able to penetrate Mali like many of the other jihadi zones we've seen thus far, and where things are going forward.
After the interview, we'll have an updated hashtag social media segment covering postings from December 15th through January 10th. But for now, here's Aaron's conversation with Andrew Leibovich.
It's now been 2 years since the French intervention in Mali to drive out al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and its various jihadi fronts and allies. In the past 6 to 12 months, though, the levels of violence appears to be on the uptick once again. To talk about what's been happening over the past 2 years, we have Andrew Leibovich on the pod today. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So before we get into some of the more recent developments, I would be remiss to ask you to provide some background on the various actors since there are many of them. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, AQIM, Moujwa, Ansar al-Din, and the MLF, and how they relate to one another, as well as sort of briefly about their histories in the Malian context before we get into some of the more recent stuff.
Sure. So there's been, on the one hand, there's been a fair amount of kind of recent change, as you noted, within the last year. But this has also been happening for several years. And really, at least in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a progression toward fragmentation on the one hand of jihadi groups. And I'm thinking particularly of the creation of the movement for Tawhid and Jihad in West Africa in 2011. But also a kind of localization in a way both of heading off disagreement, but also sharing responsibilities, splitting responsibilities, and kind of dividing and subdividing these groups, sometimes due to competition between the groups over leadership, over recruitment, over the promotion of people, but sometimes as a response to external pressure. And I think this has particularly been the case after the French intervention in Mali in January 2013, which killed a fairly significant number of jihadis, forced some AQIM units to and Mujahid units to move elsewhere. So some people went to Libya, to southern Libya, to northern Libya. Some sort of went back into southern and eastern Algeria, possibly even toward Jebel Shambi in Tunisia. Some went into Niger, and so there's been a kind of scattering, and now people have started coming back, and I think that's been part of the violence. Now, of course, some people also never left, or they fled into southern Libya and then have been filtering back into Mali. This is particularly the case with Ansar al-Din, which was originally kind of a Tuareg jihadist faction that has come out much more. They were always working with AQIM and always very close to AQIM, and particularly the Tuareg AQIM fighters. But this relationship has become and has been made much more explicit really since mid to late 2013. Now, entering into that mix, a group you mentioned, the MLF, the Messina Liberation Front, which there's much less information about them publicly and a lot of speculation about them in the Malian press in particular, but now also the international press. And they are, at least according to reports, led by Amadou Koufa, who kind of emerged publicly with the push south that instigated the French intervention in Mali. And so at least according to the reports and according to what some locals are saying, the MLF is largely composed of Fulani fighters, so people who generally were affiliated with Mujahid before and who then subsequently split off. But if you see, there was a recent interview, it actually came out yesterday, with the Saharan emir, AQIM, Yahya Abul Hamam. And he said, actually, for the first time, that the Messina Liberation Front, Ansar al-Din, and AQIM all coordinate their actions and work together. And this is again, part of this kind of coming back together that we've also seen with al-Murabitun coming into AQIM. And so fighters that were associated with Mukhtar bel-Mukhtar now rejoining AQIM after bel-Mukhtar split from AQIM in late 2012. So as I said, there was a kind of coming apart and then a coming back together that's happened to some extent. Now, the wrinkle in this is that a small number of fighters linked with al-Murabitun's former emir and a Mujal leader, Adnan Abu Lida Sahrawi, who gave bayah to ISIS and to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But this was something that al-Murabitun denied, or it was initially framed as being in the name of al-Murabitun. Al-Murabitun Shura then denied this and said that it was not, and bel-Mukhtar said that it was not a legitimate, it was not a legitimate decision of the Shura. It was an individual thing on the part of al-Sahrawi and did not represent the organization as a whole. But it's also possible that this realignment is partially in the context of the sort of evolving jihadist scene, partially in the context of the opportunities and also the threat posed by Western and regional counterterrorism forces, but also partially due to the threat of defections to ISIS and a need to kind of reform ranks in the face of that threat.
Yeah, so switching gears a little bit and more related to the internal politics of Mali, and I think is relevant maybe in explaining why we've seen a reemergence of more violence, is obviously one of the issues in Mali has been the political process in the aftermath of the French intervention and how it's played out vis-a-vis the relation between northern Mali and southern Mali and everything in between. So I was wondering maybe if you can talk a little bit about this political process and how it's played out in the past 2 years.
Well, so it was a very difficult political process, in part because what existed before the French intervention was a kind of complicated stalemate, whereby the original, sort of the fighters who spearheaded the original rebellion in 2012, the National Movement for the Liberation of the Azawad, the MNLA, had always had an on-again, off-again relationship both with Ansar al-Din and maybe with other fighters, especially more, say, we'll say explicitly jihadist fighters. But after the North fell, these forces progressively pushed the MNLA out and fought with the MNLA in several key occasions in Gao and also in Menaka in particular. And so the MNLA was quite marginalized territorially at the time of the French intervention. The French intervention allowed the MNLA to come back into the north, but also created a very difficult situation where the MNLA was on the one hand working partially with French forces to help gather intelligence and also help identify jihadists for targeting, but at the same time that allowed them to secure their own positions and re-secure some positions, especially in and around Kidal. This then in 2014 became more serious, both with progressive Malian government attempts to retake the full extent of Malian territory and fighting that happened between the Malian government and the MNLA in Kidal in May of 2014. And then subsequently the sort of reappearance of militias associated with specific ethnic groups, mostly Tuareg and Arab groups, but then also identified as being pro-government. Now, one of the wrinkles here is also that there are persistent allegations that these militias are either tied to AQIM and Mujal or at least have links to them. And we've seen certainly some ex-Mujal fighters and ex-Mujal commanders who have now left and become part of these militias. It's a bit complicated because in interviews, some of these figures have said that they were essentially part of Mujao as a way of protecting their communities from the MNLA. And this is a pretty persistent line. People said this even during the occupation. They said that they had joined Mujao and AQIM in part as a response to the MNLA. You know, it's very difficult to evaluate these claims, but it is clear that there are at least some relationships that have endured and have made it very complicated to try to pick apart, you know, who is part of what and who is affiliated with whom. But so in June of 2015, finally, under really significant international pressure, international and regional pressure, especially from Algeria, there was a peace accord signed in Algiers that sort of gave hope about a temporary peace, but in the interim actually led to some significant fighting between these different factions. That fighting then led to another more local peace accord. And so both peace accords are sort of enforced for the moment, but it is a very, very complicated internal political picture. And even as the various sides in the conflict are trying tentatively to move toward political accord and towards something that will be longer lasting and more durable, there still remains quite a bit of instability and unhappiness at multiple levels and within different movements. And so things are somewhat calmer for the moment, I think, and this is a positive thing, at least, that we've had both an internationally recognized agreement and local agreements, but they're quite tenuous. And so I'm concerned, and I know others are concerned, that these could give way to more fighting in the future.
So how is the French sort of looking at all of this and what they've been up to and their role in everything that's been going on?
Well, so the French are in a difficult place because they've moved from a very Mali-focused posture under Operation Saval to a more regionally focused counterterrorism operation in Operation Barkhane. So on the one hand, this has meant that French forces, although they're still very present in the region and still very engaged in combat operations in Mali, but also in Niger, and maybe elsewhere, depending on who you listen to, it is harder for them to survey this territory. And at the same time, the French have made quite clear, you know, publicly and also in conversations that I've had with French officials, that they see Barkhane as a counterterrorism operation. It is strictly a counterterrorism operation. And so when you talk to French officials and ask them basically how things are going in the region, and especially in Mali, they'll say, well, Operation Barkhane has been successful in its posture as a counterterrorism operation. Of course, this leaves out the political dimension of conflict in northern Mali. And France is certainly involved in trying to resolve this conflict and regulate that conflict. But increasingly since Operation Saval, France has, I think, become less trusted by most of the actors involved because everyone accuses the French essentially of siding with their rivals. And so in trying to maintain this really difficult and very delicate balance between counterterrorism concerns, the need to protect French interests in the region, and also trying to resolve political conflict, basically everyone is accusing France of backing the wrong side. And so it really has proved to be a very challenging circumstance for France right now. Now, as I said, they're pursuing counterterrorism operations. They've been pursuing some counter-smuggling and counter-narcotics missions, but these tend to be more incidental to the counterterrorism mission, and they are really not the primary mission or the primary goal of French forces. So these also are a very complicating factor in the political and the security dynamics in the region.
So returning more to our jihadi friends, Why do you think we've seen more of a rise in violence in the past half year to a year by AQIM and the other factions that we're discussing earlier? Is it because they've been able to finally recover? Is it more related to the political situation in Mali? Is it related to, you know, trying to show that they're relevant and hopefully not, you know, bringing in IS? Or is it something else that we're not really looking at right now?
Well, I think all of these things are true to some extent and play a role. Because on the one hand, you have people who fled during the French intervention who quietly began to come back. You also have other fighters who never left or who simply kind of quietly slipped into their communities, into local communities. And I think this is a very important factor to consider. And then as Mali's government has continued to struggle, as French forces have been spread out, I think these groups saw the opportunity to come back and to return to, on the one hand, a larger pace of operations, particularly IEDs, but also some mortar attacks, rocket attacks, and complex ambushes in the north, but also to expand their operations into central Mali and into southern Mali, including in Bamako, as with the attack in November against the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, but also an earlier attack on a very popular bar in Bamako and another attack on or sort of a shooting at UN vehicles and a UN compound in Bamako. So I think part of it was opportunity, part of it was a sort of gradual return back to Mali, or a reemergence for those communities that, or for the people who went underground and went into hiding. And some of it, as I said, could also be a way of staving off ISIS. So I think this is important, but I also think that we shouldn't exaggerate it or shouldn't assume that everything is related to IS. This is something that after the attacks in Bamako, after the attack in Bamako, after the Radisson attack, many people's first reaction, and I certainly had plenty of conversations with journalists in particular who asked, well, is this related to Paris? Because the Paris attacks were just a week before. And I think for many people, the automatic assumption is that everything that is happening with Al-Qaeda-linked groups right now is somehow in response to ISIS. And this is part of the story, but it's not the whole story. You know, there's also a very complicated return to insecurity in various parts of Mali that is a separate discussion to some extent and is a separate issue to some extent, or at least part of these interrelated but still different factors of insecurity in Mali, but also the integration over many years of jihadist forces and some local communities and recruitment among some local communities, that the insecurity in Mali has allowed, I should say, and the insecurity in Mali has allowed these groups to perpetuate that and also to be much more open about it. So there, it's very interesting because there was a recent video that AQIM released from the depths of the Sahara that largely followed one katiba, Katibat al-Furqan, led by a local figure. He's of mixed parentage. I think one of his parents is from Mali, one of his parents is from Mauritania. He grew up in Libya part of the time. So he's sometimes referred to as Abdurrahman al-Libi or Abu Talha al-Mauritani, Abu Talha al-Azawadi. Depending on the recent video, it's al-Azawadi. But this video features, on the one hand, a number of what people have identified as themes associated with IS. So a nasheed associated with IS, some sort of media symbols and propaganda texts, especially referencing future attacks in Rome and elsewhere. But it also showed a scene of Abu Talha and AQIM fighters intervening in a communal meeting north of Timbuktu in the town of Bushbeya. And on the one hand, there can be a debate maybe about whether or not they were really warmly welcomed or not in this very local setting. But to me, it demonstrated at a minimum that AQIM still has this ability to operate on a very local level. And it shows also the depth of this familiarity with local meetings and local politics, you know, even among like Arab tribes north of Timbuktu. And so on the one hand, you have a very globalized discourse that is tied into themes of propaganda and media production in Syria and elsewhere, but also very local politics, these hyper-local contexts that AQIM and affiliated groups are still very familiar with and very involved in, and that they use to leverage their own operations and to be able to operate in these areas.
Yeah. So related to AQIM specifically, have we seen in their actions more recently any influences of lessons learned from their experience when they were in control of different cities in northern Mali, or how they operated in the lead up to their takeover of cities sort of in 2011-2012, whether from the new relationships they've built in Libya, or the fact that the leadership of AQIM and the leadership of AQAP seem to be coming closer and closer together in the last year?
Yeah, I think that's true, though. The relationship between AQAP and AQIM has existed for several years. If you remember, as the Associated Press revealed from letters they found in Timbuktu, AQIM leaders, including the group's Emir Abdelmalek Drukdal, were in conversation with Nasser al-Wuheshi and others during the occupation of northern Mali. And if you remember, there were Yemeni connections between the GSPC, there were connections between the GSPC and Al-Qaeda that were facilitated by Yemeni fighters and figures. There was at least one Yemeni Al-Qaeda member who was dispatched to Algeria in the 90s and also later to evaluate the group and to evaluate the Algerian jihad. So there are connections that go back much further. In terms of lessons learned, I think that's quite hard to say because I think they still remain fairly committed to these goals, though I would argue that potentially, this is very speculative, but one of the reasons why there may have been fewer defections to IS in the region could be that, you know, AQIM has this recent governing experience, and AQIM helped establish a particular version of the Sharia in northern Mali, and this happened for some time. So that might also be a way of saying, you know, we've already done this. You don't need to join IS. Again, that really is quite speculative, but I think it's a possibility. And now at the same time, as AQIM has reemerged, let's say, in about the last year, they have targeted international forces, so French forces, UN forces, but they've also been targeting local officials and people they've described as collaborators. And they've done this quite publicly, in fact. So in some cases, in the areas north of Timbuktu, they have kidnapped local officials, they have executed local officials, tribal leaders, tribal chiefs, sometimes in front of others. They've also publicized the execution of three people who they said were spies for the French quite recently. And other groups like the FLM, or the MLF, sorry, I was using the French acronym. The MLF has also killed several imams that were reportedly opposed to their presence and opposed to what they're saying. Now, the MLF in particular has reportedly said that they still want to implement the Sharia. And there are some questions about what they're actually trying to do. Again, there's very little sourcing and very little information about what specifically they are doing in central Mali. But so I think part of this reemergence, again, is happening against international forces on the one hand, but is also happening on a local level as a way of trying to perhaps secure the space to operate, but also potentially pave the way to take on a more forceful public role in these areas. Now, for the moment, I think that's very difficult with the French presence, with the international presence in Mali, but that is certainly their stated goal, right? It's still the expulsion of foreign forces, and to gain or maintain a presence and a place in northern Mali and in Mali as a whole.
Yeah. Going back to sort of, I was actually going to ask you this, but you alluded to it a little bit in the previous question related to the Islamic State and why they haven't really been able to gain any influence in this arena. You also mentioned previously Abu Walid al-Sahrawi and former leader in al-Murabitun. You know, it's interesting because compared with most other main zones where jihadis are operating, Mali really hasn't even been touched by this issue at all in some ways. Is it possible, in addition to your explanation, because we haven't really seen, at least last decade or in the last few years, that Malians went to Iraq or went to Syria? And do you think that because Libya is so close and we have seen some videos from IS in Libya trying to reach out to Tuaregs in Mali and elsewhere, that they're actually attempting? And have we seen any evidence that IS has sent any emissaries down there to try and start cells or anything in Mali?
There has been some limited evidence of this, again, based on some really scattered information. So the Algerian government, for instance, said several months ago that it killed a small number of IS fighters or IS-linked fighters who were in southern Algeria on their way to Mali. And as you know, there was an IS video produced in Libya that featured, I believe, two Libyan Tuareg addressing a message to other followers. But there hasn't been a tremendous amount of outreach. And what outreach has existed doesn't seem to have been that successful. So al-Sahrawi gave bay'ah to Baghdadi, but it wasn't recognized by Baghdadi. Or at least as far as I can tell, it wasn't formally recognized. You don't have an IS wilaya in the Sahel the same way you do in Nigeria or the same way you do in Algeria. And so it's an interesting question, and I, to be totally honest, I don't know if I can really say why that is. You know, to the same extent that you can give explanations or various explanations that are both historical and contemporary for why there seem to be fewer Algerians fighting in IS than past conflicts, or certainly when compared to, you know, Tunisians or Moroccans. So you can give some reasons why it might be, but we really don't know. And you can see these sort of interesting analytical trends, or things that seem out of place, but it is very, very difficult, at least for me, to try to explain this. Maybe someone else has an answer to this and I don't. But it is a bit of an open question for right now. And, you know, perhaps these efforts will intensify. Perhaps for the moment, IS doesn't see it as an attractive or as attractive a place to operate. I think one possibility, and I outline this in a piece that will be coming out very soon. One possibility, I think, is that as anti-IS operations continue in Libya, their fighters might get pushed further south. So into southern Libya on the one hand, but maybe even into places like northern Niger and northern Mali. And so that's something to watch out for. But for the moment, at least, and I really want to stress that this is for the moment, AQIM seems to have largely held off IS at least in the Sahara and in the Sahel.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting dynamic when you compare it to other areas where there has historically been a lot of jihadi activity. So as a historian, I won't ask you for any predictions, but what can recent history and the current trends do to inform us about potential trajectories and scenarios going forward? Being sneaky there.
How much time do you have? That is a tough question. Because on the one hand, you know, the natural attraction, I think, for historians is to say that, well, the past obviously informs the present. But at the same time, the security situation, you can say the jihadi scene, but also just the political and the social environment in northern Mali, but also the Sahel in general, has been changing quite dramatically for some time now. And so that actually makes it very difficult to draw. Obviously, you can draw some comparisons to the past, but I'm somewhat reticent to that given how dramatic some of these shifts have been in the social environment, in relationships between communities, in the growth of narcotics trafficking and human smuggling. All of these things make it very difficult. I think what we can say is that the region has, to some extent in the past, been subject to security trends elsewhere, in the sense that the initial introduction of fighters into the Sahara came about in part due to pressure on Algerian jihadist groups by the Algerian government, and that many groups that felt under pressure elsewhere were able to find some sort of safe haven in northern Mali that helped contribute to these groups putting down roots there, but also helped contribute to the security situation there and the eventual security situation. But again, it's important not to overplay this, since that was as much a consequence of these broader political changes and also political conflict, for instance, between some Tuareg groups and the government, that went back to the founding of Mali and Mali's independence. I'm gonna skirt that question a bit, just because while I do think it's very important, it's also important to understand, and maybe that's the historical link, that these changes that are underway that impact jihadist groups are also part and parcel of much broader social and political and economic and ecological factors that have been buffeting the region for some time, and that jihadi groups operate within that, obviously, but also that these changes impact the societies in the region and the governments in the region in a way that extends far beyond whatever impact jihadi groups have. And that it's important to understand them within that context and to understand that they are not the only things going on in the region.
Always an important thing to remind many people. They're not in some vacuum by themselves.
Exactly.
Anyways, well, thanks for coming onto the show today, Andrew, and explaining the varying dynamics in Mali.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from December 15th through January 10th.
During that time period, two foreign fighters with IS were killed in Yemen from Ethiopia and Saudi Arabia. Also during that time period, 15 foreign fighters with IS were killed in Iraq, while in Syria, there were 18 foreign fighters killed with various groups. And finally, during this time period, AQAP announced 40 military operations.
On December 15th, Wilayat al-Janoub of the Islamic State reaps the potato crop in Al-Zawba.
Also on the 15th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State gives a tour of their military equipment shop in Al-Tabqa, Syria.
On December 16th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna does a cleaning campaign in the East Coast neighborhoods of the city with its Sons of the Martyrs Association and the Public Works Company.
Also on the 16th, Wilayat Barqa of the Islamic State fixes the electricity in Harawa, Libya.
Also on the 16th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State starts building the Al-Sahaba Mosque in Talifar, Iraq.
On December 17th, Wilayat al-Anbar of the Islamic State graduates the Abu Ali al-Ansari class from the Sheikh Abu Ibrahim al-Zaydi training camp.
On December 19th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State shows off its Sharia court in Sirte, Libya.
On December 20th, Harakat al-Shabab al-Mujahideen collects and distributes zakat of cattle in Juba.
On December 20th as well, Wilayat Abyan of AQAP has a dawah forum in Zanjibar, Yemen.
On the 21st, Wilayat al-Furat of the Islamic State does a raid on a drug dealer finding more than a million narcotic pills in Abu Kamal, Syria.
On December 22nd, Jabhat al-Nusra puts up posts on the wall reminding people of the importance of prayer in Jabal Zawiya.
On December 24th, Ansar al-Furqan, a Sunni jihadi group based in Balochistan, Iran, claims responsibility for an attack on Iranian forces in the town of Dara.
On December 24th as well, Majlis Shura Thuwar Ajdabiya, which Ansar al-Sharia in Libya is a part of, and some of their members recently pledged bayah to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, distributes fuel.
On December 24th as well, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State shows off olive picking in the town of Al-Qatar al-Waqa, Syria.
On December 26th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State clears roads and buildings after an airstrike in al-Raqqa city.
On December 27th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State puts up new dawah billboards in Mosul.
On December 29th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State shows off the Fire Rescue Authority in Mosul.
On December 30th, Wilayat Sinai of the Islamic State graduates a new class from its sniper training camp.
Also on December 30th, Jabhat al-Nusra passes out dawah literature in al-Badia region.
On December 31st, Liwa Shuhada al-Yarmouk of the Horan Plateau in southern Syria denies that they gave bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Also on the 31st, Wilayat al-Fallujah of the Islamic State shows off the work of its agricultural greenhouses.
On January 1st, 2016, Falak al-Sham, an Ikhwan-like Islamic group, backs out of the Jaish al-Fatah alliance due to it veering further into hard jihadism.
Also on January 1st, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State gives a tour of the kidney unit at the hospital in Tal Afar, Iraq.
On January 3rd, Jabhat al-Nusra shows off a Sharia course in Jabal Zawiya.
Also on January 3rd, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State shows off the work of the Control and Inspection Office in al-Raqqa City.
Also on the 3rd, Wilayat Dimashq of the Islamic State puts on a dawah forum for its Cubs of the Caliphate in the city of Hajar al-Aswad, Syria.
On January 4th, Wilayat Sinai of the Islamic State kills two alleged spies in Rafah, Egypt.
On January 5th, Harakat al-Shabab al-Mujahideen executes five people for allegedly spying in southern Somalia.
On January 6th, Jabhat al-Nusra puts on Quranic memorization lessons for little girls in al-Badia region.
On January 7th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna holds a ceremony for the opening of a new medical office.
And finally, on January 9th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State builds a new media point in the town of al-Tawim, in the Al-Mahlabiya district, Iraq. If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter where we are @jihadpod. We'd like to thank all the patrons, especially Hakan Jar, for supporting the show. If you'd like to help support the podcast and get some cool rewards, you can check out the Patreon link in the show notes. As always, the show is available on Stitcher and iTunes, and if you use one of those platforms to subscribe to the podcast, please consider taking a moment to rate and review the show, which will help more people find it.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Andrew for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.